Good afternoon. I'm Kurt Dewhurst, the director of the Center for Great Lakes Culture and the Michigan State University Museum. I want to welcome you this afternoon to another one of the Center for Great Lakes Culture MSU Library Colloquia Series presentations. We've been doing these in cooperation with the library. I want to thank the library staff for all their support along the way. And we're very pleased today to be having a presentation by one of our Center for Great Lakes Culture visiting scholars. And I might just take a moment to say that the center has been providing over the last couple of years funding that supports research on the Great Lakes region. And we do it in a variety of different ways. We've provided fellowships, 1 month fellowships at the Newberry Library for scholars who want to take on a project there. It's not restricted to just MSU faculty or staff, but also to any scholars in our region, frankly across the country, but who are doing work though on Great Lakes culture. That's a strong partnership program between the center and the MSU Library and the Newberry Library. And in addition to that, we've been providing an MSU faculty fellowship each year, as well as support for visiting scholars to come and do work here using the resources of Michigan State University. And we usually try to work them into our colloquia series so that you get a chance to hear a little bit about their research. I'm very pleased today to be able to introduce Dr. Adriana Green, who is here in the capacity of one of our visiting scholars. She's the interim director of the Nokomis Learning Center, many of you know, out in Meridian Township. And she's a visiting faculty member here at MSU, and some of you may know her even as faculty here today. She's going to provide an overview of Ojibwa and Odawa quill work on birch bark. And the topic of her presentation today is Anishinaabe Arts of Quill Work and Birch Bark. And before I just turn it over to her, I have some cards up here. I want to urge you to visit the Nokomis Learning Center and also to visit the Michigan State University Museum if you haven't had a chance to see the exhibit of photographs by Tom Jones. We have an exhibit at the MSU Museum called Honoring the Ho-Chunk Warrior and a companion exhibit of Tom Jones' photographs out at the Nokomis Learning Center. I see Dr. Krause is here, who is the curator for the exhibition and worked with Tom Jones. So we have a blessing of many activities to take in, and very pleased to have Adriana here to talk to us a little bit more today about quill work on birch bark in our region.
Thank you, Mohit. These are my notes. I'm keeping these. Hi. Oh, wait. I have two mics. I just had it right. I'm up. Okay. I'll stay away. Hi. Welcome. Thank you for coming, taking the time this lovely afternoon, sunny afternoon. I'm pleased to be here. I'm grateful for the opportunity of through the Center of Great Lakes Culture to engage in some exciting and fun research. And I will be talking about that later on. I'll give you an introduction, a historical introduction about Great Lakes quill work on birch bark, and then give you an idea of the kind of work that I will be engaging in this summer or pursuing this summer. I'll start here with a map of the region. If you're not that familiar with it, just to give you a mental pinpoint of the places I'll be talking about. In particular, I'll be looking at art from the Cross Village in Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa here in this northwestern Michigan. Along Lake Michigan area. I'll be looking at, we'll be seeing something from Perry Sound here on the shores of Georgian Bay. And also then the focus of my research is actually gonna take place in Ontario, and we'll talk more about that. I'll have another map for you at that point. Great Lakes quilled birch bark is an established artistic traditional form among the Ojibwa and especially the Odawa of Michigan and Ontario. And it has roots in the long intercultural moment around the fur trade that takes place in the Great Lakes. there's a lot of speculation about specific design origins, and I'll briefly address those as we go along. But in terms of the objects that we have, that we're looking at, that are collected in museum collections and that have been collected over the course of time by visitors, diplomats, dignitaries, missionaries, we have a nice idea, representative idea of the evolution of the art of quill work on birch bark from this area. And I should, just to give you a little more in detail, by quill work on birch bark, I'm specifically talking about the use of porcupine quills that are collected from porcupines and used to decorate objects made with birch bark, which of course is plentiful in the Great Lakes region. Among the earliest shapes and forms of birch bark items that we are familiar with from collections, we have the onakan, which is this particular shape flaring on the sides of as a bowl, trimmed with sweetgrass, which is around the edge. And the makak, which is this other birch bark container, often with a cover, but not exclusively, which flares in the other direction. This particular object is representative of a type of birch bark container decorated with sgraffito design, where you remove a layer of the very thin paper-like layer of the birch bark, and therefore create designs that are with contrast of the lighter and darker birch bark as you do that. These objects and these kinds of objects date to the early 19th century, and in particular, some of these are collected, or in a collection in Italy, actually, of Beltrami, who traveled in the Great Lakes region up to the Mississippi in the early 1820s. Interestingly, the Beltrami collection, which is one of the earlier ones of Great Lakes art, doesn't have any artifacts that are decorated with quill work. But it has quite a few birch bark artifacts decorated or either plain or decorated with this kind of design. So that gives us an idea that perhaps in the earlier part of the century, quill work wasn't used that much for decoration on birch bark. We see a few uses, mostly incorporating quill work on the edges of these kinds of containers. But again, it's very minimal, and as we'll see, nothing as dramatic as the kind of objects that, in fact, do start appearing in collections that date from the 20s, the 1820s onwards. So we're going to look at different stimuli, shall we say, different kinds of objects and how they were collected and where they come from. As the Great Lakes region got increasingly settled by non-native peoples, especially in the 1820s, there were a lot of opportunities for intercultural exchange, communication, interaction. Some of these opportunities were diplomatic. This wonderful example of a canoe model, small, decorated here with quill work, which has been dyed in different colors, and also with a person, little model in it, is an object that was given to Lord Elgin when he visited in the 1850s, early 1850s. The date of collection of this object and a couple of others is a little not quite traced. other than we know that Lord Elgin, who was the Governor General of Canada during between 1847 and 1853, traveled to the Great Lakes region and possibly was given these objects near Georgian Bay in Sarnia, where he was visiting. And these are actually objects that are identified as coming from this Parry Sound, Georgian Bay area. I think it's about this big, if I recall. I've actually seen this. This object, this canoe, and this other collection, also of Lord Elgin from the same trip, are part of the Thaw collection that's on view on permanent loan at the Fenimore Cooper Museum, upstate New York, in Cooperstown. So if you were to go to Cooperstown, I would urge you to stop at the museum. It's a wonderful collection of Native American art, including these objects that Lord Elgin collected, or were given to him and his wife, I should specify. Again, the exchange of objects of particular value for the Native population to dignitaries and visitors is one of those identifiers of the kind of relationships that are being established, and also the kind of the place that these objects have for the Native populations. So when they're giving particular objects, we identify, you know, that they're important, that they're considered very important, and obviously they're quite beautiful. We see different things represented here, a little box decorated with quill work with some animal fish shapes on the top here. I'm sorry, is it a little fuzzy, the picture from? Probably will get fuzzier, though. Okay. But here, obviously, we have geometric designs. We have a little bonnet, baby bonnet, made of birch bark with this incredible, beautiful design and colorful quill work, which is this floral design here in this edging. A little container with floral design on it, and this little model of a wigwam, which you can see on this. I don't know if you can see very well what's going on. There's actually a man on the right. He's hunting, and he's shooting at a bird, actually. And I have the other side of it, which is the hunter. They came from different publications, which I scanned. I apologize for one looks better than the other picture, but the hunter and presumably his wife or companion. Coming back, so that's a little model of this little wigwam, which is a very unusual item, actually. As far as I know, it might be quite unique, actually. But these are the kind of items that were given to visiting dignitaries and important people that had some kind of interaction with the Native populations. Occasion and opportunity and moment of interaction occurs with missionaries that settle in the Great Lakes region and promote and encourage the production of Native crafts, often because, or so we glean from their writings, because the Native population would make these crafts, might sell them, and give the money that they made to the mission to support the missionaries' activities. So missionaries kind of like to encourage these kinds of production, cultural productions. But in particular, one collection that stands out is a very unique set of objects is this altarpiece and six candlesticks, which is made. It's actually made of wood and covered with a veneer of birch bark, which has been decorated. I apologize again for this image. I couldn't get it bigger. But I think you can see that it's all these floral, intricate floral designs. This piece was made in 1846 for the mission at Cross Village. And it is now in the Museum für Völkerkunde in Vienna. as it was brought back to Vienna as part of a traveling exhibition to raise money for the mission by a Bavarian man, Martin Pitzer, who was a church painter who went to Cross Village at the mission to paint their church. And it, in fact, replaced the native-made altarpiece with his work, but then took the native-made altarpiece and took it to Europe along with a few other objects and displayed it as this, you know, interesting and exotic cultural production of the natives of the Americas, and so, you know, help us fund our mission among these people. In terms of design, the elaboration of this floral design seems to be at least partially stimulated and closely tied with missions. And again, it's a design that's very pleasing, that is not threatening, doesn't seem on the surface anyway to recall any native ideologies and religious expressions as other native designs might. So the missionaries were kind of pleased by this. So they encouraged the elaboration of floral design. Also, in terms of generally the elaboration of floral design in the Great Lakes, there's an attribution of the interaction of nuns, Catholic nuns at missions, and for instance with the Huron, Huron Wyandot, which were Catholic Huron in Quebec, who learned embroidery from nuns. So in terms of the development of a floral design, we kind of have, again, a moment of interaction between different cultures and interests as well. Now, there has been also some work by scholars done in looking at the other side of this floral cultural production, which is I won't go into here, but with kind of trying to identify what would be the stimulus and the reason why Native people would actually do this floral design. And maybe it's a little more complex than just being encouraged by the missionaries to do so. But that's another talk. Another opportunity for the creation of these quilt objects comes with the market in curiosities and souvenirs that, again, happens in the mid-19th century and into the late part of the 19th century from Niagara Falls all the way through the Great Lakes region at particular points that are identified as resort areas like Niagara Falls or other places where there's a large enough settler population that appreciates these objects. Vacationing spots such as Mackinac up on the northern part of Michigan. This photograph is actually of Will Shurtleff on the left and Henry Giroux of Cross Village up on the western side of the state selling Odawa quilled bark souvenirs. 1895 to 98 is the date that's attributed with this photograph. And what we have here is boxes. Can you read the writing here from where you are? Okay. The object that he's holding in his hand, actually, the white part that's in the middle says paper. Okay, that's a birch bark envelope, quilled, decorated with quill work, that is sold for use to non-native people, to Euro-Americans and visitors for uses that they might have for it. And here we're talking about the production of souvenir art, again, making things for a market, and the fact that the market supports artists making objects, and artists then making objects that are of interest, of particular interest to the populations that are buying them. In fact, I have a couple of objects here. This is one, it's not one of the specific boxes in the picture, but it's one like it. There's gloves. This is all quilled, this beautiful floral quill work. not dyed except for the accents of yellow, and then this pink, reddish pink dyed writing, and this is gloves. Okay, this is a box, a lidded box, obviously containing gloves. This is a kind of object that will be made for the souvenir market. I forgot to point it out. Right here is a little model of a cradle, like this one. It's not the same cradle, but it's like it. Again, this one dates from the 1890s. There's this beautiful, wonderful little object decorated just with these delicate little quilled flower designs. And of course, there's another intersection which is worth mentioning, which is the intersection of the cultural, the souvenir market and the Victorian cult of domesticity that also develops at this time period, where women are encouraged to decorate their homes with nice, fine objects of craft work that we call, you know, skilled artisanship. California native basketry is another big item that gets acquired at this time that fulfills this Euro-American notion of the proper home. You know, the women dedicate the parlor to their little display area of these kinds of objects, and they acquire them. So the objects that we see also fulfill this notion in their shapes, in their forms, in their decoration. Okay, so we see a lot of these really pretty little different kinds of containers, scalloped edges, which I always associate with Victorian for some reason. I don't know why. It must be the doilies. This one in particular, and the next couple that I'll show you are, this is a purse, Birchbark purse. It actually opens also with this very elaborate footwork design on it. These are also part of the collection that's in Vienna that was brought over by Pitzer as a display of the arts and skills of the native populations of Michigan, which were responding to this sensitivity of the time. A wall hanging, sorry, I think it might be a little blurry, but so it's just a range of objects. Again, heavy duty on the floral filled design. A little tray, which works beautifully as a place to put your visiting cards. You call on someone, and in the parlor might be the little tray, and you put your visiting card there. And it's this, again, this beautifully quilled object. And I have a couple more just to give you the range of shapes and sizes. Very creative time period, very innovative. Again, even if the stimulus is a market for these objects, there's also just this elaboration, this embracing of the opportunity to really do a lot of, you know, fun things with birch bark and decorate it. Fan, also very Victorian in its time period. Worth mentioning Margaret Boyd, who was the sister of the Odawa leader Andrew Blackbird. And she was, in this photograph, she's actually in her room. And there's a filled basket here, which we have in color. She provides another example of the kind of impact that this artistic production had for Native peoples. She was active politically, obviously comes from a political family, a family of standing and leadership. And she traveled to Washington to meet with the president to lobby him on behalf of the Odawa tribe. On her trip to Washington, which took her, I guess, through Chicago, somehow, I'm not sure, I guess the train went from Chicago, she had been given a canoe, a quilt canoe, to present to the president. And what she did instead was she sold the canoe for, I think, $50, which was a pretty high price at the time, and sold other objects that she made, and bought appropriate clothes, meet with the president, and decided that, you know, the best use of these items, rather than as presentations, would be to really put her in a position where she would be empowered in her negotiations. So her presentation of self was really something that was important. Yeah. You got me there. Whoops. Late 19th century, so we're talking probably McKinley. I think Roosevelt, yeah, I'll have to get back to you on that. You got me on that. Oops. I have, like, you know, the third quarter of the 19th century. But anyway, so this is another example. And Margaret Boyd was actually recognized as a premier co-worker in her community. And another really interesting object collected by Father Purbrick, a Jesuit, probably at Garden River, Ontario, in the late 1870s. And it is this birch bark house. The lid opens, and it's either a box or a purse. It actually has, you can see the ties, it has a sweetgrass string attached to it, so you could wear it as a purse. I don't know that it was ever worn as a purse, but we'll see a few more of these objects. But again, there's this really, you know, really fantastic elaboration of an object and the little woman in the house. I mean, this perhaps is to demonstrate, you know, the acceptance of you know, new ways that are imposed, perhaps to assuage. I don't know that anybody knows the specific history of this one object and how it ended up with a Jesuit. But as a type, we'll see a few more of these, and they're quite intriguing, such as this one, which is in the collections of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Again, it's just, you know, this little house. It opens up, the roof opens up on both sides, so it's anchored along the top of it, and it's just this really sweet little object. And these are, again, late 19th century. These two that I'm showing you are from the 1870s, 1880s. So keep that little bit in mind. They're about this big. So whatever that is. Now, in terms of historically how the quilled birch bark continues as an art form, we have a continued production of these kinds of objects. And in the 30s and 40s with the WPA period, the Work Progress Administration, and after the Indian Reorganization Act, which promoted and supported making native crafts, and then the WPA period, which encouraged them even more as an economic opportunity for native people. Especially across village, again, in Michigan, we have a center of production for quilled birch bark items. So here we have a photograph from Cross Village WPA workshop, and here is a photograph of Mary Agoza Mixamung, who was the manager of the Cross Village WPA workshop for a time period. And here she has in her hands a birch bark filled box with a lid. Okay. And the kind of objects that are continued to be made are boxes, fully quilled like this, elaboration of geometric designs. This scalloped edge kind of starts in the 20s and continues into this time period as a little feature, a decorative feature. So we have fully quilled geometric designs. We have floral designs that are elaborated also at this time period, but a little different from the kind of floral designs we've seen so far in that it's just the abstraction of the flower as a centerpiece in a background sometimes the background is not fully quilled, or it's fully quilled, like in this case. All that quills. Now, all these little dots, if you've never seen a quilled box, is where the quills enter, are inserted in the birch bark to fix them. So essentially, the quills are, you know, they could be about this long, a couple of inches long, and holes are made in the birch bark, and then the quills are inserted in one hole, and they go in one and out the other hole, and so it's stretched along the surface. So wherever you have these holes is where actually the quill has to go get inserted inside, under, and a new piece of quill comes, gets also put there, if I explain that in any in any way that he could understand. Just to give you a range of the designs and shapes, other boxes, we see a lot of these round boxes being produced during this mid-century, 20th century time period with a lot of different designs. Here we have, of course, a bird, a pretty realistic bird with flowers, and these geometric quilled renditions. Actually, these are quills that are crisscrossed, blue quills crisscrossed here, and then white quills crisscrossed for the other inner design. We'll see another example that shows that a little better. These are more contemporary quill boxes. These are from the Michigan State University Museum collection. And conveniently, when you open the drawer, there's this little grouping with different birds. So we got a photograph of that from different contemporary artists. Again, to just give you an idea of the continuity here of design. We have realistic birds. I guess it's a red-winged blackbird, I assume. A couple of are those chickadees, I think. Something like that. A thunderbird, which is actually a traditional Great Lakes native design. So it's very different from these realistic other birds. And then an eagle. Again, all these beautiful, creative. Well, these are made as works of art also for sale. I'm assuming the museum purchased them. So the WPA is the period. Yeah, maybe you can say it's this moment where is it art, is it craft, but really it's made for sale. I mean, I would say it's art, and that's certainly the reason for it, and that's certainly why it was encouraged also for people to sell. Right. Yeah. Although, you know, there are local, you know, trading posts that are around that kind of emerge and that have these objects, you know, that are locally made, especially up in the Cross Village area. So, you know, I think if you looked at more specifically the local level, what's going on, maybe you can make the determination of what kind of prices these things might have brought in at what time. And I think that's more a feature of you know what else is going on in the economy and what the economy can bear in terms of art production. This is also from the Michigan State MSU Museum. Again, another geometric. You see a little better the use of these quills here in this crisscross pattern, and then an inner crisscross pattern of in this case different colors, and then a nice central flower at the top. Also in the MSU Museum, a house. And I believe this one was made in the 1990s, but again, there's this long history of making these houses. And that is something that I will be investigating, and I'll bring you up to date in a minute as to why I will be investigating it. I would be remiss, however, if I did not mention Yvonne Walker-Kieschek, who is perhaps the premier contemporary artist, and she sells them as art, as she should. Here in Michigan, she's from the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa, and she comes from a family line of filmmakers. She learned from her aunt, Irene Walker, and her other aunt, Susan Kyojima Shagonabe, who's the daughter of Marianne Kyojima, pictured here in the 1930s from the same area. You see here some of Mary's quill boxes. These have little animals, figurative animals on them. And she's here at work. So Yvonne continues this tradition of family, artistic family lineage, which is actually something that's very important that needs to be explored more. And on the left here is one of Yvonne's pieces. It's this wonderful, huge quill box. It's also in the MSU Museum. And it's just incredible. Very complex elaboration of patterns. She's developed really a lot this the use of the actual natural black part of the quill as this fading in and out for colorful effect of the design and shading and accents of particulars in the representation part. I also want to mention Elizabeth Kimmewan, this quill box also in the MSU Museum. Elizabeth Kimmewan is, well, until last month, was one of our local artists. She's actually from the Manitoulin Island area originally, just moved back to the northern part of the state. But she's also a wonderful artist that works in this medium. Now, this brings me to the point of my work and the need for focusing more on these lineages of artists and communities, both specific family lineages of artists, but also the wider communities in terms of how they've supported over time the artistic production and of quill work. The work that I'm doing, sponsored by the Center for Great Lakes Culture, brings us to Massey, Ontario, which is up there, which is actually on the north shore of Georgian Bay, just north of Manitoulin Island, which we see here. Massey is essentially right there. That's Massey, right at the edge of this map. The work I'll be doing is actually a collaboration with a young woman who lives in Detroit, Andrea Chusan Pishi, who is Sagamok Ojibwe from that community, and whose grandmother, Evelyn Toulouse, is a wonderful premier quill worker, well-recognized in her community in Massey. So Andrea and I are collaborating on this project. Andrea is actually a photographer, so these photographs are all hers, and we will be using her photographs throughout the project. But Evelyn Toulouse has been working in the medium of quill work for over 70 years, and she was taught by her mother, who was originally from the Manitoulin Island, from the Wiki community out there. So there is, again, the opportunity for tracing how communities have maintained and elaborated perhaps styles in the quill work, which is actually very intriguing. Evelyn makes a lot of other objects as well, but quill work is really her main thing. She's 87 now. We have a picture of her here at about 2 years of age, which is a wonderful little girl here. This is dated about 1920, this photograph. And she learned from her mother, this lady seated in the white dress on the right, Mary Louise Boyer, who I'm not sure where she learned the craft, but I'll be sure to find out, hopefully. But again, there's a long tradition here. Here we have another house. This one is made by Evelyn Toulouse. It is in Andrea's personal collection. There's this house and this fantastic brick house. And the intriguing thing is that Evelyn Toulouse apparently started making these houses very recently, or recently enough, but really based on the recollection of watching her mother make them. And then, there's some intriguing area there to explore in terms of the continuity and the specific elaboration of these houses as a genre, if they come out of a particular community, or how that moved around. But these are contemporary pieces, but again, quite close to, you know, 100-year tradition. And just to wrap up on the research to be, Evelyn Toulouse has spurred another generation. Her son Francis is also a quill worker. And as Andrea says, his quill boxes are more masculine. So we'll see what that really means. We'll try to get to the bottom of that statement. Nancy Abiton, that's Abilene Sinnelbert, who is Andrea's aunt and a daughter of Evelyn Toulouse, also a quill worker. And I'm sorry this is teeny, but if I blow it up, it gets out of focus. But if you really wanted to see this box made by Emmeline, it's at the Nokomis Learning Center. It so happens. And it's big, it's beautiful, and it's expensive. So, but, you know, I would encourage you, even though it's for sale, we have quite a few of this family's quill boxes at the center. So even if you're not in the market to buy any, I would certainly encourage you to come see them because they're wonderful. I think it's 700 plus, and it's quilled on the sides. Again, it's you know, about this big in diameter, and it's quilled all around the sides, and it's. That's something I'm going to, since I'm an anthropologist, I'll go there and measure how long it takes people to make things. But it takes let's say weeks. We could say months, and I'm sure that like any traditional artist, you know, you do more than one thing at the same time in terms of, you know, the things you're making, plus, you know, running your life. So you're not just sitting there, and so it's kind of hard to quantify, I would think, you know, how long exactly it takes. So though I'm sure they can quantify it. And yeah, and that too as well. And collect them, you gotta find the porcupine first and go from there, right? Yep. And then Mina Toulouse. Another relative here, also engaged in the art, and here's this other huge, I don't know, this family, they're making these big quill boxes. This one, I've also seen this particular one, and Andrea is holding on to it in her personal collection. She's not selling it. It's just this beautiful quill box, but again, with this flower motif, which we see over and over again. We see it a lot coming out of the Manitoulin Island community, which this family really traces itself back to. So again, there's something really interesting about the designs that I'm going to try to explore. And Nancy Abitong, who is not a direct family member, but part of the same community, has also been making quill boxes. And here's one of hers. And here you can really see the elaborate crisscrossing motif with the quill work. And these flowers that are three-dimensional, again, made by crisscrossing the quills and knotting them in particular ways. Again, something that seems like a lot of people out of the Manitoulin Island area make this particular design. But also, it seems that this Evelyn Toulouse has kind of stimulated other members of her community, the Sagamore community up in Massey, to make quill work. So again, the extent of it will be seen thanks to the support of the center. And I think that's my quick run through the history of quill work. If you have any questions, we want to try to answer them. All these boxes are actually in sweetgrass. Now, traditionally, sweetgrass would be used as an edging, whether the box is quilled or not, in the traditional containers, because it actually helps keep insects out. And the traditional containers were really made for use. Among some of the earlier items, actually in the earlier, very early 1820s market, some of the first things that we see decorated with quill work a little more elaborately are these bowls containing maple sugar that would be sold to the tourists at Mackinac Island and Quebec, Montreal. And that's where we first see really the use of quill work as this design that really kind of yes to all of that. Historically, the dyes would be natural materials. The quills take very well. You have to essentially simmer them in the dye, which is diluted in water. So you have a pot of water with whatever it is that's going to give you that color that you want, be it berries or minerals for natural dyes. And today with commercial dyes, absolutely. And then you simmer the quills, and then you take them out, and you dry them out, and they take the color pretty well. Now, the earlier, the natural dyes are a little, don't hold the color as well, so they tend to fade over time in a lot of these older pieces and collections, unfortunately. Plus, they have, which haven't been treated necessarily, in terms of collection practices and preservation practices, haven't been treated too well, so a lot of them have the color. Color has faded, but today they use commercial color. That's actually a technique where you knot the quills and drag them through, and these are, of course, a different color, so it creates this little, these little series of knots at the center. Yeah. Well, there seems to be actually a connection with Maine and the eastern part with the Atlantic provinces, Nova Scotia populations out there that had Mi'kmaq and Maliseet that had been making actually quill work designs on birch bark a little earlier than we see them apparently in the Great Lakes. And there seems to have been some intercultural contact between the various populations and these objects moving around. Now, again, I'm a little, weary to categorize that in any decisive way, that it's, diffusion. And certainly they're using porcupines in some porcupine quill decoration in some ways. In other media, besides birch bark for sure, on clothing and other items. So it is certainly a local indigenous material that is used for decoration. In terms of the elaboration of the designs, I think it's better to kind of look at the historic moment where there's a lot of different things that come together that generate more of this production. So you have, the contact with people, in Nova Scotia perhaps, that are making their quill work on birch bark, but also all the missionary impetus to do floral design. Another kind of use of birch bark is embroidery with moose hair, which actually is something that the nuns are encouraging women to do in Quebec. So again, you have and those items with moose hair embroidery are heavily decorated in floral designs. So again, you have like another little impetus. Shall we say, another little contribution to the elaboration of this particular art form in this area. The whole Victorian, they especially around Niagara Falls and the Mohawk and Iroquois people, again, supporting the market in particular kinds of objects, but decorated with beadwork rather than millwork, so. It's a really fascinating time period. There's a lot going on, a lot of meeting points. Yeah?
thunder words and underwater panthers, probably. Oh. You know, the native, you know, pantheon of deities and forces, spiritual cosmic forces. Thank you for coming.